Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Brian Lynn, Jill Robbins, and John Russell. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Brian Lynn.
Mozilla has released a new update of its Firefox browser that it says is much faster and provides a better overall user experience. But can the new version, called Firefox Quantum, compete with the world's current top browser, Google Chrome? Firefox is an open-source browser created by the not-for-profit Mozilla Foundation. The foundation says it has different goals than companies like Apple and Google, which must focus on making a profit. Mozilla aims to create new products to keep the Internet a global public resource that remains open and free to all people. It urges developers to contribute to its technology and use the Firefox source code with other products.
Firefox 1.0 launched in 2004 when Microsoft's Internet Explorer dominated the browser market for personal computers. Firefox also followed the failure of Netscape Navigator, another major browser that did not survive the competition from Internet Explorer. Navigator had also been used in Mac computers. But in 2003, Apple released its Safari browser, which is still used today. The number of Firefox users grew over the years, offering a challenge to Internet Explorer's global influence. Wired magazine reports Firefox currently has about 90 million users around the world. While this is a big number, the overall browser usage for Firefox worldwide is still quite small, about 6%. Google Chrome is leading with 55% browser usage, while Safari has about 15%.
In launching its new version, Mozilla said Quantum is by far the biggest update in Firefox history. The most important message Mozilla is sending is that Quantum is fast. Really, really fast. Is this true? And what else can this browser do? Is it worth downloading and taking for a test drive? Yes, it is fast. The new Firefox performs today at speeds twice as fast as just 6 months ago, tests showed on the Speedometer 2.0 system. The speedometer measures how the browser handles many different web operations at the same time. There have been mostly positive reactions to the speed of Firefox Quantum by technology publications and the public. Digital Trends noted the browser was faster and even more minimalist. It added, "Firefox Quantum makes Chrome look old." PC Magazine said Quantum had made major progress with turbocharged performance, a new look, and better memory usage. Firefox user Eric Berlin tweeted his results. "In all seriousness, I spent the day using Firefox Quantum, and it really is faster than Chrome, with a smaller memory footprint and less battery drain. Worth a try.
Mozilla says Quantum was built to greatly reduce the amount of computer memory used. In its own tests, Firefox researchers found the new browser used about 30% less memory, or RAM, than Chrome. One result of lower memory usage is that more pages can load faster and operate at the same time. Earlier this year, Mozilla developer Dietrich Ayala even reported Quantum was able to open nearly 1,700 separate browser tabs in just 15 seconds. Quantum also provides private browsing controls that block ads and do not remember the user's history.
Firefox Quantum comes with a new design featuring blocked tabs along the top with a wide search box below. In the middle of the browser are links to the top sites you visit, as well as recommended and trending stories. Quantum also includes Mozilla's Pocket Bookmarking service, which works to quickly save web pages and content for later use.
A new tool, Firefox Screenshots, makes it easier to cut and save any parts of the browser screen. Mozilla said Quantum's browser is the result of studies on how people use the web today. We looked at real-world hardware to make Firefox look great on any display, and we made sure that Firefox looks and works like Firefox, regardless of the device you're using, Mozilla explained in a blog post.
Firefox has been using Yahoo as its default search engine for the past 3 years after signing a deal with Yahoo. But that ended with the launch of Quantum. So even though the new browser is a clear competitor to Google Chrome, Mozilla decided to give its users default access to the hugely popular Google search engine. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
In the 1964 action film Goldfinger, actor Sean Connery plays the British secret agent James Bond. Bond, also called Agent 007, is well known for his drink of choice, a martini. He always wants his martinis prepared just the right way. Let's listen to a short exchange from the movie.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
Today, we will show you how this kind of exchange can teach you something about English grammar. Specifically, it shows you how English speakers use sentence fragments in everyday situations. We will also use fictional conversations to show two common ways in which English speakers use these fragments. But first, let's start with some definitions.
Complete sentences are sentences that have both a subject and a predicate. A predicate tells something about the subject. For example, in the sentence James Bond likes to order martinis, the subject is James Bond and the predicate is likes to order martinis. In this case, the predicate gives us information about Bond. In writing, you should use complete sentences. However, in conversation, you can use partial or incomplete sentences. Incomplete sentences are not wrong. In other words, English speakers are not breaking rules when they use them. Instead, speakers leave out parts of sentences because the sentence's full meaning is clear from the setting or context. Today, we will explore two kinds of incomplete sentences, one group called minimal responses and another called short answers.
Minimal responses are simple words or expressions that speakers use to react to what somebody else has said. These are not complete sentences. They sometimes lack a subject, verb, or other important part of a sentence. Americans commonly use minimal responses for two purposes: showing approval and giving a polite or respectful answer. We will now look at examples of both types.
Imagine you tell your friend that you received a great grade on a difficult test.
I got an A on my test.
Nice.
Here, your friend uses the adjective nice as a way to express approval about your statement. The reason your friend does not use a full subject and predicate is because his or her answer is understood in the context of a conversation. Some other words and expressions that show approval are good, good job, great, nice, and nice work. All of these terms have similar meanings. However, some are more forceful or less official sounding than others. Think back to the example you just heard.
I got an A on my test.
Nice.
A speaker could replace the word nice with almost any of the other terms we provided. They could say good job or great job, for example. Great job is a stronger statement than good job.
Americans also limit their responses to make points in a respectful way during a conversation. Some of these are polite, yet informal. The most common examples include no problem, no worries, sorry, and thanks. Imagine someone has just given you directions. You might want to thank them before going on your way. The exchange might sound like this.
Thanks.
No problem.
The other person could respond in an even more informal way by saying, no worries, instead of, no problem. In both cases, the speaker's response takes the place of a much longer sentence. For example, the speaker could have said, I was happy to be able to help you out. No problem is a short, polite way to express this same idea.
A second type of incomplete sentence is the short answer. In short answers, speakers leave out subjects, verbs, or predicates. In general, the missing words appeared earlier in the conversation. Speakers do not repeat these words because repetition would make the exchanges much longer. Let's consider an example. Imagine you are looking for the nearest bank. The person you ask might provide a short answer.
Where is the nearest bank?
Right over there.
In the example, the speaker omits the subject and verb of the sentence. The speaker said, right over there, instead of the full sentence, the nearest bank is right over there. If the speaker says right over there, he or she means that the bank is very close to you, probably within eyesight. In many situations, speakers will point with their fingers to show the direction of the bank. Think back to the lines you heard earlier in this report.
Can I do something for you, Mr. Bond?
Just a drink. A martini, shaken, not stirred.
In the example, James Bond uses the same type of short answer, an answer that omits the subject and verb. Bond could have said, I would like a drink, a martini. I want you to shake it, but please do not stir it. This way of speaking is much more detailed, a lot longer, and polite. It does not fit with James Bond's personality. He is not a very polite, talkative man. That said, you can still learn from how he uses language.
The next time you are watching a film or speaking with an American, try listening for examples of incomplete sentences. When the speaker uses an incomplete sentence, ask yourself if they used it for one of the reasons we talked about today. Does the sentence leave out important words, such as a subject, verb, or predicate?
If it does, no worries. I'm Jill Robbins.
And I'm John Russell.
From VOA Learning English, this is The Making of a Nation, American History in Special English. I'm Steve Ember. This week in our series, we tell about the conflicts among the nations in Europe during the 18th century and how they affected North America. During the 18th century, Spain, France, and Britain controlled land in North America. Spain controlled Florida. France was powerful in the northern and central areas. Britain controlled the east. All three nations knew they could not exist together peacefully in North America. The situation could only be settled by war. The powerful European nations already were fighting each other for control of territory and riches all over the world. These small wars continued for more than 100 years. They were called King William's War, Queen Anne's War, King George's War, and the French and Indian War. The French and Indian War was fought to decide whether Britain or France would be the major power in North America. France, its colonists, and their Indian allies fought against Britain, its colonists, and their Indian allies. The war began with conflicts over land. French explorers had been the first Europeans in the areas around the Great Lakes and the Ohio and Mississippi rivers. France had sent traders and trappers to these territories and had established trading centers there. Britain claimed the same land. When the king gave land in North America to someone, the land was considered to extend from the east coast to the west coast, although no one knew where the west coast was. The land along the east coast had become crowded, and settlers were moving west. White people were destroying the Indians' hunting areas, and Indians became worried that they would lose the use of their land. The Indian tribes might have been able to resist the people moving west if they had been united, but their own conflicts kept the tribes apart. When Britain and France started fighting each other, some Indians helped the British. Others helped the French. The French settlers lived mainly in what was called New France.
Today, it is part of Canada. Life there was different from life in the British colonies to the south. For example, there was no religious freedom. All settlers in French territories had to be French and belong to the Roman Catholic Church. So many French people who belonged to Protestant groups settled in the British colonies. These French Protestants were known as Huguenots. France also did not like the fact that the British paid the Indians high prices for animal furs. France was more interested in the fur trade than in settling the land. The British hurt the French traders' business when they bought fur from the Indians. One of the French trading centers was built in the area where the city of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania is today. The French called it Fort Duquesne. The British claimed it was in Virginia, and therefore that the land belonged to them. In 1754, the governor of Virginia sent a 21-year-old colonist named George Washington to tell the French to get out. This was the same George Washington who would later become the first president of the United States. The French refused to leave Fort Duquesne, so Washington and 150 men attempted to force them out. They attacked a group of Frenchmen and killed 10 of them. The French and Indian War had begun. British troops under the command of General Edward Braddock joined George Washington at Fort Duquesne. The British general expected to fight the way battles were fought in Europe. There, troops lined up on open fields and fired their weapons as they marched toward each other. Fire! The French and Indians did not fight this way. They hid in the woods. They wore clothing that made them difficult to see. They shot at the British from behind trees. The British had more troops than the other side, but the French and Indians won the Battle of Fort Duquesne. General Braddock was killed. Most of the French and Indian War was fought along two lakes in an area of what is now New York State, near the border with Canada. One was Lake George, the other Lake Champlain, north of Lake George. It reaches almost all the way to the city of Montreal in Canada. These lakes provided the best way to move troops and supplies during the French and Indian War. Few roads existed in North America at that time. The military force, which controlled the lakes and rivers, controlled much of North America. The French had military bases in the cities of Quebec and Montreal. The British had bases along New York's Hudson River. The area between them became the great battleground. Fighting increased after the British defeated the French near Lake George in the final months of 1755. The French then built a new base to control Lake Champlain and the surrounding area. The French base was at the southern end of Lake Champlain. They built a strong camp or fort. They called it Fort Carillon. The fort would control Lake Champlain and the area needed to reach the northern part of Lake George. The fort was designed to provide a strong defense against attack. The French built two big walls of logs several meters apart. The area between the walls was filled with dirt. Later, a strong stone front was added. Troops inside the walls were well protected. The British built a similar fort at the southern end of Lake George. They called it Fort William Henry. France sent one of its best military commanders to take command of its troops in America. His name was the Marquis de Montcalm. General Montcalm attacked several British forts in 1757. One of these was Fort William Henry on Lake George. The British commander was forced to surrender. General Montcalm promised that the British troops would be treated fairly if they surrendered. But the Indian allies of the French did not honor the surrender agreement. They began to kill British soldiers and settlers. No one is sure how many people died. It could have been more than 1,000. In 1758, a strong British force attacked Fort Carillon on Lake Champlain. General Montcalm was the French commander. Fort Carillon was strong enough that the smaller French force was able to defeat the larger British force. The British withdrew, but attacked again the next year. This time, the British commander was General Geoffrey Amherst. Amherst was successful. The British defeated the French. They changed the name of Fort Carillon to Fort Ticonderoga. It became an important military center in the French and Indian War. Fort Ticonderoga would also become important later during America's War for Independence. The Battle for Quebec was the turning point in the conflict. Britain and France signed a treaty to end the war in 1763. The British had won. They took control of the lands that had been claimed by France. Britain now claimed all the land from the east coast of North America to the Mississippi River. Everything west of that river belonged to Spain. France gave all its western lands to Spain to keep the British out. Indians still controlled most of the western territory, except for some Spanish colonies in Texas and New Mexico. Today, you can still visit the two forts that were so important in the French and Indian War. Not much remains of the original buildings. However, both have been rebuilt using the original designs. The area surrounding both forts is very beautiful, including the two lakes, Lake George and Lake Champlain. Many people travel to this area to enjoy the outdoors. The area includes one of America's National Historical Parks, Saratoga. It also includes the Lake George Beach State Park. Few people who visit this calm and peaceful area stop to remember the terrible fighting that took place there 250 years ago.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.